Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, it was not, has led many Republican-controlled states to pass voting laws that would restrict access to the polls in ways that appear to make it more difficult for some to vote. At the same time these laws were being passed, the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act were making their way through Congress. The For the People Act would have overridden the actions of state governments and set national election standards, guaranteeing access to vote by mail and early voting, among other things. The John Lewis Voting Act would have restored the full strength of the Voting Rights Act, which had been weakened by the Supreme Court. Both bills passed through the House, but hit a wall in the Senate. Even though Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer insisted failure was not an option, fail they did, not due to lack of support, but because of an arcane rule in the Senate, the filibuster. There was the potential to override that rule just for a vote on these bills, but Republicans were aided in their resistance by two Democrats, West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema. Where did the idea for the filibuster, which in this instance allows the minority to control what is brought to the Senate floor, come from? It has been waived in the past, so why not now? And at a time when voters are losing trust in our institutions, and when it appears that our very democracy is at stake, how could this happen and what will it mean for our future? To help us understand and unpack all of that, we're joined by Caroline Fredrickson and Jonathan Weissman. Caroline Fredrickson is a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and distinguished visitor from practice at the Georgetown University Law Center. She has served as the president of the American Constitution Society and was recently named to the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. Caroline, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jonathan Weissman is with us. He's a congressional correspondent for the New York Times, having previously covered Congress and the White House for the Baltimore Sun and other aspects of government for USA Today. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
After that big buildup, that is why we originally invited you, but after that big buildup, we're going to start in a completely different place, because yesterday the news broke that Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer would retire at the end of his term. His official announcement is supposed to come sometime today. The White House has known about this for about a week. So let's begin there. Caroline, you're a member of the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States, whose mission is to provide an analysis of the principal arguments for and against Supreme Court reform. And we've gotten to this stage where, through some clever manipulation, Republicans have been able to put three justices in one presidential term on the Supreme Court, tilting it in an entirely different direction, so that what was considered by many and what was allegedly considered by these new justices to be settled law, Roe v. Wade, may not in fact be so settled. And some say that the Supreme Court, although it's not supposed to be a political body, no longer reflects the majority view of most people in the United States. If that is true, and we'll talk about Justice Breyer in a second, but what does it mean for a democracy in which minority views are the final word on many serious issues, and when the people begin to view the Supreme Court as a political institution?
Well, you know, that is the fundamental question of constitutional law. I'm teaching constitutional law now and legislation, so it's an interesting contrast between the two classes. But the basic question is, you know, how do you resolve what's called the counter-majoritarian difficulty? That is, you have this body, a Supreme Court that not elected, our courts at the federal level are not elected, and yet they sit there in judgment on decisions of the popularly elected bodies. And so there is a tension in democracy. If you believe in judicial review, which is the ability of a court to make a decision about whether a law is how to interpret it or whether it's even constitutional, you confront this question right away. How this has been managed over time, it's been managed with difficulty, right? There's been a lot of back and forth around the court. I mean, there were protests against Earl Warren after the Brown v. Board decision, and the Warren court was very much under attack by conservatives. But because of the interaction between the filibuster and Senate procedures and some sleights of hand by Republican presidents, as you've mentioned, the court has become even more conservative over time than would be indicated by the normal ebb and flow of the appointment process. And right now, where you have a very large majority of the citizenry that supports, for example, a reproductive choice for women, the court seems to be rapidly moving in the other direction. And there are a whole number of other areas where the court has seemed really out of step with popular opinion. Again, the court's not supposed to reflect popular opinion directly because it's supposed to uphold the Constitution. But when it seems to have such a different point of view about the Constitution and what it means than the vast majority of the public, you start getting into a real tension about whether our democracy can survive that.
But Jonathan, we have this swing in the court, and we also have this moment in our history in which Republicans seem to be actively and transparently trying to make elections come down on their side. And we have the situation, which we're going to talk about later on in this program, where the filibuster, which allows the minority to essentially control what's brought to the Senate floor, where the minority is in charge of everything. And the minority is the minority for a reason. So what kind of a democracy do we have here if the minority controls at least two and possibly in 2 years, 3 years, three branches of government?
Well, it's been noted also that the Senate itself, since time immemorial, since it was created, it does not really reflect the views of the nation at large. I mean, at this point, a senator from Wyoming with, I don't know how many, 400,000 people has the same power as a senator from California. And that situation, as the nation sorts itself into megalopolises on the coasts and the center, especially the West, hollows out, the power of the minority in the Senate and rural voters only gets much more amplified. So that issue keeps mounting. What kind of democracy do we have? And I think that, you know, let's see how the election unfolds in 2022. We're already starting to see in the primary, there's a primary coming up in Texas, and we're already starting to see terrible backlogs in mail-in votes and absentee ballots. Republicans keep saying that Democrats are way overstating the impediments to the ballot box. But thus far, in the only test that we have, this developing Texas primary, we are seeing exactly the problems that were feared.
Getting back to the Supreme Court, Justice Stephen Breyer is one of the last progressives, one of three progressives on the court, and many would describe him more as a pragmatist, and he has decided at 83 to retire. That gives President Biden an opportunity to nominate a younger person for this court seat. If the president follows through on his campaign pledge, it will be a black woman. But given the court's conservative majority, does the replacement of one progressive for another or a black woman being on the court really going to have any impact whatsoever? They're not in control.
No. I mean, this is a decision for the future, but the ideological balance of the court will not change because of this decision. I mean, when you see Sonia Sotomayor's dissents of recent months, you really start to feel the frustration and anger on that three justice block of more liberals because they simply have very, very, very little power.
Well, you know, I agree with Jonathan, but I would emphasize that this is a decision for the long term. That clearly, if one of the women that's been suggested is successful in being confirmed, you know, you have somebody who's in her early 50s, and that makes a real difference in terms of the long-term ability to make a change in the court's direction. I'd also say, though, that there, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but there's a fair amount of internal back and forth and negotiating that goes on, and that might get a very different kind of valence, or the way that justices interact with each other, may be able to persuade each other to join in certain opinions, may be different. Now, it may not be, but Justice Breyer is a certain kind of personality, as you mentioned. Pragmatist and moderate, I think, are more really appropriate to describe him than, you know, progressive, liberal, et cetera. And so if somebody comes on with a kind of different orientation, it might change certainly the type of decision that comes out, even if it changes the tone of a dissent.
And the age question is an important one, because these folks are appointed for life. They don't have to retire. They can stay, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg did, until they pass away. Yesterday in the Washington Post, Aaron Blake wrote an interesting article about all of this, in which he mentioned that the trend has been toward appointing younger justices because they have longer to take advantage of these lifetime appointments. Amy Coney Barrett, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, the latest three new judges, will probably, he said, be able to spend three decades on the Supreme Court or more, where the average term has historically lasted 16 years. Now tenures are growing on average perhaps to 35 years in the next century. Does that mean that Democrat or Republican, we should consider changes to these lifetime appointments, Caroline?
Thank you for that question. It was exactly what the commission was considering. It is historically very out of step. And I think this maybe comes back to your original question about how far the court is out of step with the public, because when you get these incredibly lengthy terms and you have somebody who was appointed 30 years before, it locks in a point of view and an orientation towards legal questions that may not be reflective of contemporary understandings of the Constitution. And so that is another tension that produces undermines democracy and the whole idea that we have judicial review in the system. But one of the reforms that the commission considered was the idea of term limits. I have to say, I'm a proponent. The commission was not allowed to say we like or don't like. We were only allowed to say, here are the arguments for and here are the arguments against. Now, that being said, I think term limits are important reform. We're completely out of step with the world, even with our own state Supreme Courts, and having a Supreme Court where people serve for, you know, the term is under good behavior, but it's been interpreted generally as for life. But nowhere else in the world do they do this. And even on our states, I think only Rhode Island has this system. So now I'll turn it over to Jonathan, but just to say one other thing. I don't think this is where a reform that's sufficient for many people who think that the court is too out of step right now. It's too far away from what the general understanding of the Constitution is, and way to the right of where it should be. And therefore we need other reforms that will address that. This is a long-term good government kind of reform, but it's not really the one that speaks to the moment.
Jonathan.
Yeah, I was struck by the commission's I wouldn't say recommendation, but discussion of term limits, because, you know, in past decades, over time, you've seen justices drift toward the center or even to the left. And I think that a lot of Democrats, liberals thought at one point that an appointee of a Republican would eventually become more liberal or at least more centrist. And what we've seen of late, I'm thinking Clarence Thomas, is that doesn't seem to happen anymore. These are more ideological appointees.
Although it appears Chief Justice John Roberts is trying to maneuver the big ship toward the center, so he is more in step. The court is more in step with the electorate. We'll talk about that and many other things, including the filibuster, which is why our guests are here today. Jonathan Weissman from the New York Times, Caroline Frederickson from the Georgetown University Law Center. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Supreme Court and Justice Stephen Breyer's announcement yesterday that he is planning to retire. He will make his official announcement sometime today, and that leaves an opening for President Biden on the court. We're joined to talk about that and later on the filibuster and these various acts that were held up in Congress because of it. with Caroline Fredrickson, senior fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, and Jonathan Weissman, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. The White House said yesterday, Jonathan, that it has always been the decision of any Supreme Court justice if and when they decide to retire and how they want to announce it, and that remains the case today. They were saying they weren't going to comment on it until Justice Breyer himself comments on it today. Is it likely that Justice Breyer has been encouraged to retire prior to the midterms so that President Biden has an opportunity to appoint a younger person to the bench, because this could be his only shot at this?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no way that Justice Breyer had not heard the drumbeat. In fact, reporters like our own Adam Liptak had asked him about this because he is the oldest member of the three-member liberal bloc, for lack of a better term. And as you said, this could be the last chance. Democrats hold a single seat majority, not even a 50-50 Senate. And if the Republicans take control of the Senate, we know what Mitch McConnell would do. He blocked Merrick Garland from being considered for the seat of Antonin Scalia for an entire year. And there's no reason to believe that he would let any Democrat, a Democratic appointee on the court if he is back in control of the Senate.
So do you think he saw what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her staying on the bench beyond the Obama administration and the result of that, and used that as a way to maintain his legacy on the court?
Yeah, he certainly saw what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and he saw what happened with Anthony Kennedy, who retired in an interesting dance to let Donald Trump appoint his successor as well. I think that it's become clear that these are much more political appointments.
And we saw, Caroline, we saw that the Republicans move very quickly in the last three appointments and resulting in the appointment of the three people that tilted the court to the right. They did it very quickly. It seems to me that they're going to have to do this extremely quickly because the Republicans cannot mount any opposition to this, really, because they changed the rules made this a simple majority vote. But they could. The Democrats are on this precipice. They lose one vote through death or illness or something else, and this is not going through.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, there are some very elderly members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate, one never knows. I certainly hope that they will live forever, but they probably won't. And it's really important that they get out of the box as fast as they can. Now, I think Senator Durbin's already announced that they're ready to go in the New York Times. I saw the piece today. We got to be honest, this isn't something that is, you know, a surprise to Biden at all. They've been preparing for this since before he took office. They've had their lists. We know of some of the names already. They've got a longer list. He's been vetting. They've been working with senators already. This stuff is just, they don't wait until the moment, even if they don't know for sure, you know, in advance that the justice is going to retire, they are prepared. And in this case, Breyer's retirement was so likely that they were ready to go.
Yeah.
Don't have to overstate this. Remember, one of the leading candidates, and remember, President Biden during the campaign had promised to name an African-American woman, the first African-American woman to the court. So there's a list of candidates that have been developed. One of those, Ketanji Jackson Brown, was already confirmed to the Court of Appeals with three Republican votes. There's no guarantee that Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Senator Graham would be there for her this time, but there is a good chance that one or two of them would be. So
would that seems to matter anymore, but would that be hypocritical for the three Republicans who voted for her appointment to the appeals court to not vote for her at all for her appointment to the Supreme Court if she ends up being the nominee? How would that be?
You know, I don't think it matters to them, honestly. You know, okay. I hate to say that, sounds terribly cynical, but you know, I've been a Senate observer for a long time, and a staffer in the Senate, and Susan Collins is not somebody who I've ever seen vote against her party when her vote mattered. And so I just don't think she's somebody to count on. If it comes down to the actual final vote and she's the one, I don't see her pulling Ketanji Brown Jackson over the finish line.
Another name that's been floated is that of South Carolina U.S. District Court Judge J. Michelle Childs, who has the support of House Majority Whip James Clyburn, who helped get Joe Biden elected, and the people of South Carolina gave him their primary votes, which got him into the front runner's seat in the last election. Does that move her up in the list of possible replacements, Jonathan?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, Representative Clyburn has in the couple of years since he basically buoyed President Biden's nomination for the presidency, has been very uninhibited in using that influence. I am sure that his choice for the court will be considered. That doesn't necessarily mean she will get it at all, but yeah, there's no way that the White House can just snub Representative Clyburn.
Caroline.
I'd say there's another interesting thing about this is that, whereas I think Ketanji Brown Jackson obviously has the recent confirmation, her stellar resume and so forth. But Clyburn's nominee, the interesting thing is that you have a different background, right? And to the extent that Biden wants to emphasize this kind of working class roots, Childs has comes out of a very different background. She didn't go to an Ivy League law school, and she served on a state Supreme Court. South Carolina, that does raise a question on Lindsey Graham. You know, where will he go? Again, I wouldn't put my money on him. But still, it changes the stakes a little bit for his calculation. And I think it makes the nomination discussion somewhat different than if it was Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Well, we'll see what happens in the next several days, because I'm sure all this will start happening very quickly once Justice Breyer makes his official announcement later on today. But let's move on to the topics that we initially invited you to be with us on this program for, and that is a discussion about the filibuster and about these various voting rights acts, etc. And I know that the media has been talking about the voting rights bills and the filibuster for weeks, but not everybody is a political junkie like me. Not everybody follows the news as carefully as the three of us. And if you just look at what happened last January 6th, there are certainly a lot of people who do not possess a deep understanding of how the government is supposed to work. Since you, Caroline, have been involved in this for most of your professional life, and you spent time working in the Senate, and you were at one time the chief of staff to then-Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle, explain the filibuster, why it came to be, how it has been used, and how exceptions have been made to its use.
Well, let me just first say I was deputy chief of staff to Tom Daschle, and I was chief of staff to Maria Cantwell from Washington State, so I don't want to claim something that I didn't have. But I spent a long time working for Tom Daschle when he was a Democratic leader. And so the filibuster is basically a way of blocking legislation. The Senate functions through what's called unanimous consent, because as Jonathan's already mentioned a number of ways, the Senate is a weird animal, undemocratic, and unrepresentative of the population. It also doesn't operate by normal parliamentary procedure. It doesn't have a motion to call the previous question. And so you can't end debate in the normal way. You have to, so this was called the filibuster. And in order to create a mechanism to actually end debate in the Senate, they adopted something called the cloture motion in 1917, which required a supermajority vote initially of 2/3 of the Senate. That's now 3/5 of the Senate, or 60. But so in order to end the debate, you have to, if somebody's objected to ending the debate, you have to file a cloture motion, then have this vote. And there's a lot of time that's built into this. So it's not just that you have to have a supermajority, but that it also takes a whole lot of time to get through the process. And so the Senate is a functionally ungovernable in some ways. If you want to actually get anything done, every single senator has the right to blow things up.
And we've watched that firsthand not too long ago, in the last couple of weeks. Jonathan, a fellow named Adam Gentleson, who was the deputy chief of staff to the late former Senator Harry Reid, wrote a book that we talked to him about just before all this began with the filibuster, called Kill Switch, in which he says Southern states or Southern senators created the filibuster as a means of obstruction to preserve white supremacy. That would echo the beliefs today of a lot of progressives in terms of how it is being used today. Is he right, or is he looking at that through a particular lens that's a little skewed?
Well, I know Adam well, and I think he is mostly right. But I mean, it is true that one of the very first filibusters, I think it was 1892, Caroline, you can correct me, was over a civil rights voting rights bill. The most famous filibusters of the 1950s and 60s were invariably over civil rights. But look, the Democrats have used the filibuster often on gun measures, on things like, you know, national concealed carry rules, abortion restrictions. There have been, it has definitely swung both ways. And for a time, until they finally did away with it, Democrats and Republicans used the filibuster to stop nominees of the president to the courts and to his cabinet and to his team. So the filibuster has been used increasingly widely. At one time was actually a fairly rare event, but before they started really chipping away at it, it was used on the most insignificant measures. So you can't just say that it's only a civil rights issue.
Carolyn.
Well, so I agree with Jonathan. Generally, I think the really significant filibusters have been over civil rights issues. The famous ones from
I think Caroline, we're having a problem with your audio. You suddenly sound like Darth Vader. Let's try that again.
Okay, is that still bad?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Well, I was just saying that I think I agree with Jonathan, but that, you know, that really the most infamous filibusters have been those civil rights filibusters, which were lengthy. The filibuster of the 1964 Civil Rights Act took 6 weeks in the Senate. But I think it's important to remember that we don't have the filibuster the way we used to. It's not a Mr. Smith goes to Washington world, because in their reform of the filibuster in the 70s, I think it was in 75 when they lowered the threshold from the 2/3 to the 3/5 or to 60. They also allowed the Senate to basically consider piece of legislation not consecutively, but at the same time. So somebody could object to a bill, and then assuming they could work something out, instead of keeping the Senate in session on the objection and trying to get through cloture, they would push that aside and move to something else that they could actually do. So this just meant that people could then object freely and never be forced to admit it on the floor. The American public then lost track of who is actually blocking things.
But I guess the question is, why does it exist at all? This is not in the Constitution. This is merely a Senate rule. And the Constitution gives both houses of Congress wide latitude in terms of making up whatever rules they want to operate under. And this is one of those rules. But it seems to be antithetical to helping the Senate live up to its motto of being the world's greatest deliberative body. It stops debate completely, dead in the water. Well, Jonathan,
if you ask Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona or Joe Manchin or any number of Republicans right now, they would say that the filibuster exists to foster bipartisanship. And the fact is that major legislation that has overcome the filibuster has received broad bipartisan support, 70, 80 votes. We just saw it on the infrastructure bill. And Democrats, when they were in the majority, the minority, also said, oh, the filibuster fosters bipartisanship.
But that was in another era. There is no bipartisanship anymore.
So I mean, what happens is you get a few cases, for instance, the infrastructure bill that just passed, and that case somehow is imbued with magical qualities to imply that if we could do it, then we could always do it. Of course, that's not
money. Money always greases the skids.
Yes, wow. In fact, an infrastructure bill used to be the easiest thing to do.
Well, as one of you said, this used to be a rarely used technique, and now it's become more frequently used. In fact, the filibuster was considered a nuclear weapon, only to be used for issues that were absolutely the most important thing. And now the reverse is true. The filibuster is used all the time, and any talk of getting rid of the filibuster is considered to be the nuclear option. How did this switcheroo, Caroline, happen?
Well, as I said, there was this change in the 70s where they allowed legislation to basically move forward to the consideration of legislation, even while there was a cloture motion pending on another bill. So there'd been an objection on the bill, say it was a voting rights bill, objection. And instead of then forcing everybody to go to the floor and debate that and hold the floor, they allow that to be pushed aside and say, we'll go to an infrastructure bill instead, because that makes everybody happy. So that meant that, you know, the mere objection to a piece of legislation had, you know, the ability to push it off. And in essence, that made it so cost-free for senators to object to things and never really have to pay the price politically. And so it's just become, you know, every bill now requires 60 votes as a result.
Well, every state, as we've mentioned, gets two senators. And when the framers designed the United States Senate, I don't suppose that was a big deal, because Virginia and Massachusetts, although they were bigger and smaller states, they were both all, everybody was rural, and it seemed fairer. Today, when Montana has two senators and North Dakota has two senators, and they have tiny populations in comparison to California, which has two senators, it seems to me that you're encouraging minority rule. And with this 60% filibuster rule, it's even worse. Jonathan, is that what the framers intended in 30 seconds or less?
Well, I actually think that the framers somewhat did. Remember, this was the Great Compromise, and this was the fight between Southern states, which were more rural, and Northern states. Northern states wanted it to be based on population. Southern states wanted it to be just allotted to the states. And they came up with this Great Compromise in which there would be two chambers. So in fact, the founders did envision this. It's just gotten a lot worse than they could have imagined.
Jonathan Weissman, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. He's here along with Caroline Frederickson, senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and the Georgetown University Law Center. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the filibuster and how it was used to stop two pieces of voting rights legislation from coming to the floor. Very important pieces of legislation for the Democrats, who are in the majority in the Senate, but a slim one at that. And we're talking about it with Caroline Frederickson, senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Jonathan Weissman, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. The filibuster was used this time to stop voting rights legislation from going through the Senate. And Caroline, according to the Brennan Center, Republican legislators have introduced more than 400 bills in 48 states to restrict the vote. 33 bills in 19 states have become law. And the Brennan Center characterizes this as, quote, the most concerted attempt to roll back voting rights since the Jim Crow era. Surprisingly, in the course of doing this program, I have discovered that there are a lot of people who don't know what we're talking about when we talk about Jim Crow. So remind us of what voting was like in the Jim Crow era for African Americans.
Well, that's quite a question. You know, I think it is unfortunate returning to us, but it is the idea of in the Southern states, all sorts of restrictions that were put in place to make it impossible for Black people to participate in the voting process. So even though, you know, after the Civil War, we adopted the Reconstruction Amendments, including the 15th Amendment, which enshrined the right to vote, or said that there cannot be discrimination on the basis of race in voting, the Southern states then all turned around to start adopting a variety of mechanisms like literacy tests and poll taxes And there were also efforts to make it hard to get to a polling place. Lots of things that were very explicit, much more explicit than happens now, but were designed specifically to prevent the Black population from participating in the democratic process.
And would it be safe to say that the reason we're returning to the same kind of situation now and the ability of these states to pass these laws is because the Supreme Court said, you don't need to do that anymore. The South has gotten over its racist phase. Is that essentially correct?
Right. Well, that's, that's exactly what Chief Justice Roberts said in the Shelby County decision, which, I have to say, North Carolina had a bill on the shelf that had been basically found unacceptable by the court system under the Voting Rights Act right before the Shelby County decision was issued. And within hours, and I'm not exaggerating, literally within hours, that bill was back on the floor of the North Carolina state legislature and passed. And it had voting IDs and moving polling places and more partisan election of judges and all sorts of things.
And I know, Jonathan, you cover the Congress and not state legislatures, but the moves being made in the state legislatures extend now beyond absentee ballots or mail-in ballots or not drinking water while you're in line waiting to vote. They're actually working on putting in place people at the elections boards and commissions who have campaigned on the big lie and who have essentially said, if I had been in place, I would have changed the slate of electors to favor Donald Trump. And that's what I will do this time around if I'm elected to this position. So this seems to make democracy, as we have known it, at stake. Why right. then would Democrats who are in a position to lose the most and perhaps everything be opposed to waiving the filibuster for this vote on these two bills?
I mean, the appeal to Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema was just that. Look, we're going to create a carve out for voting rights because voting rights and election administration, what you're talking about, are fundamental structural issues for the democracy. These are not legislation. It's not about bipartisanship. This is about saving our democracy. And even then, that did not convince them because Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema have carved out this niche for themselves as maverick Democrats and believers in bipartisanship, believers in the Senate more than the democratic process necessarily. And it just didn't work because, look, Republicans are arguing fiercely that Democrats are simply overstating this, that the case that this is a return to Jim Crowism is absurd. There are no literacy tests, there are no poll taxes, and in most states there is still longer periods for early voting, more absentee ballot access than there has been in the past. And what they would say is that what we are seeing in these new state laws is kind of a response to the very open access to early voting and absentee ballots and mail-in ballots that we saw in 2020 because of the pandemic. And they would say that they're actually improving credibility of elections with their voters because their voters thought that states had gone too far with early voting, absentee voting, mail-in voting during the pandemic.
Caroline, one of these pieces of blocked legislation, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, would have restored the full strength of the Voting Rights Act, which was neutered kind of by the Supreme Court. And it was named after the late John Lewis, a legendary civil rights leader and member of Congress who died just months ago. What does it say about Democrats? What does it say about Democrats that a bill with an iconic civil rights leader congressman's name attached to it will not get a hearing?
Well, I'm crushed by it. It's just so disappointing and distressing. I think it points to a couple of the major fallacies behind this whole filibuster debate. One is that it produces any kind of bipartisanship. I mean, honestly, when you need 60 votes, there's no point in somebody like a Collins or Murkowski breaking with their party. You know, what's the point? They'll never get to 60. They might. Now, if there was a majority vote here, there, then you actually have a point to negotiate, right? Especially in a closely divided Senate, and you could win just a few people and move forward. You'd start to have people talking to each other about getting something done. And if Manchin and Sinema were actually serious, they'd start talking to Collins and Murkowski and say, we're for this. Why don't you join us? We'll talk about how to massage it a bit. Instead, it's all or nothing. And the other thing is, I think, Jonathan, you know, we were talking about this earlier about sort of the creation of the Senate. Well, the other thing is, let's face it, the Constitution itself is designed against supermajorities in the sense that where they're explicit. You know, we have them for passing constitutional amendments. They're very specific circumstances for a supermajority vote. And many constitutional scholars think that implicitly, therefore, if it's not there, it's meant to be a majority vote. And it doesn't mean the filibuster is necessarily unconstitutional, because as we've talked about, the Senate has the ability to create its own rules under the Constitution. But still, there is no argument in favor of a supermajority requirement on top of everything else, on top of the anti-democratic nature of the Senate to start with. And I think Sinema and Manchin are just being completely disingenuous about their arguments in favor of keeping the filibuster.
Jonathan, the other act that failed to pass and even failed to get a hearing was the For the People Act, which, as I said at the beginning of this program, would have set some national election standards. I think a lot of people have presumed, even though the states run the elections, that we did have some standards. Maybe they were just tradition, maybe they were just understood, but we don't have them. They're not codified at all. And Republicans have positioned these Democratic attempts to institute these standards as attempting a national takeover of elections. Is that what this is?
That was certainly the line that was repeated ad nauseum during a day-long debate on the Senate floor. The nationalization of the election is kind of code. States' rights has always been used on these kind of controversial issues. We do not have national standards, and those standards would have to be shifted. As the Republicans noted time and time again, some Democratic states like New York have some of the most restrictive rules on early voting and absentee voting. And they have simply not really responded either. So setting up national standards would actually cut both ways for Democratic states and Republican states. And the idea here was, as you said, to have a certain number, a floor, a certain number of early voting days, certain rules around mail-in ballots, and certain rules around voter ID, among many, many other things.
So there are these diametrically opposed points of view regarding what's going on in the states with regard to voting rules. But then you have the situation, Caroline, where they are putting these people in place who may or may not decide, well, that's not a result of an election that I want, so I'm going to send a different slate of electors to Washington to be part of the Electoral College in the next presidential election. Would that or any of these rules changes be subject to a ruling by the Supreme Court, or in the absence of any national standards, would they just say, well, there's no rule on this, so you can do whatever you want to?
Well, it's a very thorny area of the law. You know, there's a whole debate about, you know, the issue of having commissions to deal with apportionment and redistricting, you know, sort of against gerrymandering, and whether or not the citizens can do that through a referendum and establish that. Because, you know, let's face it, the state legislature, they kind of like gerrymandering, right? If once you're in and you're in for life. You create your district and you will never be bounced out, at least by somebody from another party. And so but the question is that right that the citizens can do it? Because the way that the Constitution is written, it says legislatures set the time, place, and manner. It's not a anyway, there's a big Supreme Court case dealing with Arizona Redistricting Commission that starts to raise the question. Chief Justice Roberts was one of the skeptics about the Arizona program. So, you know, how the state legislature interacts with the electors whether they can change them at the last minute after the election and so forth. You know, that's, I don't think they should be able to, but I can't say that that's necessarily definitively decided under constitutional law. And with the Supreme Court, you know, everything that's decided may yet be undecided.
Jonathan.
And remember, there are traditionally two ways to rig an election. There's the cast and the count. And actually, the For the People Act that you referred to kind of got at both the cast and the count. Well, there is an effort right now, a bipartisan effort in the Senate to address the count. There is a very large group of senators now working on reforming what's called the Electoral Count Act, which is the law from the 1870s that set up the system of counting electoral votes that Donald Trump tried to manipulate to steal the election. That has a lot of momentum. And in the debate over how to change the Electoral Count Act, a lot of Democrats are now pushing changes to election administration, the count, that are starting to get some support from the Republicans. For instance, setting federal laws against intimidating or harassing election officials, setting a rule that you cannot replace a nonpartisan election official without cause. Things like that. And I actually feel like there is a chance that this issue can reemerge later this year around the Election Administration and Electoral Count Act.
A lot of what we talked about in the last half hour, at least, it makes it appear that the United States was set up not to be terribly democratic, not to really favor the winners, but give the losers a chance to control the conversation. And both parties fight for the votes of Americans and for the minds of Americans. In other fields, we say that's competition, and competition is good. When a party wins a majority, why are they willing to weaken their own power by allowing a minority to use the filibuster? Caroline, it doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Well, right. I mean, you know, one hopes that there's a certain amount of public spiritedness that is part of what brings people into office, and that they would actually care about advancing democracy. I mean, the story of our country has been, you know, a country that was founded on great principles, you know, we the people, et cetera. But we the people wasn't very many of the people at the time who actually got to have a say. And we've right. been advancing forward through the adoption of a variety of amendments to our Constitution and expanding the franchise and expanding legal rights. But we're not done yet. And, you know, I think there's a question here about, you know, how do we address that? And how do we make sure that we have a country that is not only moving forward, but really becomes a true democracy? I think in the situation that we have now, where the parties are fighting over potentially, you know, who gets the ability to participate or not based on factors that should matter, but based on partisanship and ideology. I think we're, you know, it's a very difficult place.
So, Jonathan, I have about 35 seconds left. There is talk of breaking up the Build Back Better bill into smaller pieces and passing them piecemeal through the Senate and the House. Is there any chance that some of these voter rights bills can be broken up into small pieces? Is there any talk about that?
You know, there was talk about it a while ago, and the most ardent supporters of the For the People Act were also ardently opposed to breaking it up. And I actually think they made a mistake. It was a tactical error, and it's going to be very hard to do that now. Remember, the bill that was on the Senate floor was a compromise bill that was written in part by Joe Manchin. And even that couldn't get it. So I don't think there's really a chance.
Even that couldn't get Joe Manchin.
Caroline Frederickson gets the last word, senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and recently named to the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. We should be interested. Has the report come out yet? Very quick. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. We should do a program on that. And Jonathan Weissman, congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you both for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.